Thank you, Amy. And it's a pleasure to be here with all of you. As Amy said, I have a long history of having been one of you guys. I'm still one of you guys and ladies. It's unfortunate that she said 1973 because that kind of aged me a little bit. But she didn't say I started when I was 10. You know, that's when I got my PhD. What I was going to try to do today is to kind of give you a quick idea. Let's see. How does this work? Oh, okay. To kind of talk a little bit on some recent scientific discoveries and how is the interplay between science, technology, and illustrate some of the partnership that led to those technologies. So, and I will be, even that I will be focusing mostly on Earth science, I will throw in a little bit of planetary and astrophysics just to make sure the other groups at JPL don't feel that I'm leaving them out. But also it illustrates the interplay between Earth, in the technology in particular, between Earth science and planetary and astrophysics. Because for many of the application and many of the technology, it really doesn't matter what planet you are looking at or, you know, what signal you kind of are observing. So first, always in this forum, I like to remind people what great accomplishment this community has done. Sometimes we kind of lose track of it because we are so much in our field, or in the case of people like myself and leadership at NASA, we are always focusing about the problems where there are the problems. But we tend to forget about how much progress and exciting things have actually occurred as a result of all your contribution. So in the first few slides, I put a couple of these examples. I mean, if we look at the case of Terra and Aqua, where we had AIRS, MISER, and ASTER, I mean, there were some very practical, you know, relevant measurements which were made when there was a volcanic eruption in Iceland. And that was a major contributor that people, average people who are not scientists, actually saw the value of having the space assets. The whole issue of carbon dioxide monitoring, AIRS made some of the early maps, you know, of measurement of carbon dioxide. In the case of people who live on the West Coast, you know, the measurement from JSON and about giving some indication about El Nino or prediction of the El Nino. For some of us, it might not be a big deal, it just will rain more or we have to call the roofers and so on. But the people in the agricultural field, that's a big deal, you know, for them to know if it's going to be a wet year or a dry year. So that's a multi-billion dollar kind of activity that, that could have implication on them. Recently, we also launched the Eyes on Earth, which is kind of a on the internet, which really attracted a lot of young people who are interested in learning what's happening to our planet and how can they kind of contribute to help our planet. And then when we have natural hazards or catastrophes like what happened in Haiti, and actually helping, you know, some of the, both understanding what happened as a result of the earthquake, but also basically mitigating, you know, and the rescue kind of effort, you know, to help those kind of things happening. One thing I didn't put here, which was kind of interesting, which came really close to home, about a month ago, we had a fire at JPL, on the site at JPL on the hill behind us, and some of the people who work on infrared, you know, instrument turned the camera toward, looking toward the fire to help the firefighters as they are walking up the hill to know which area are still very hot and they should avoid versus area which are cooler. So that was an immediate, you know, in our backyard kind of application. Other example, as I'm sure you know, the whole issue of the loss of ice, you know, in Greenland and Antarctica. Usually I tell people when I present it in general public, people ask, well, how do you measure that? I tell, well, just go and weigh it. We put it on a scale and weigh how much ice. I said, what do you mean? So I try to explain to them about the gravity field, you know, and how we actually measure the amount of mass by measuring the change in the gravity field from the GRACE mission. Now, throwing in, you know, one which is not exactly Earth application, but a broader application, so you can, you know, that you have a future in your business. As it turned out, there are many planets in this universe. Every time we look at the star, we find that there are many planets, you know, which are around them. Almost 50% of the star actually have a planetary system. And the way we detect it so far is by looking at the brightness of the star and see if there is a periodic dip, which means that an object came in front of it and reduced its intensity by a teeny, teeny amount, maybe one per 10,000 or one per million reduction. And you see one example that we have in here. Now, we still haven't detected an Earth-sized planet, but that's because of the sensitivity of, you know, of the telescope, not because they don't exist. So once we get a bunch of them, I'm sure Mike Freilich will expand his domain and say, well, I own all of these planets, they are all Earth-like, so all of a sudden you'll have a much bigger program. More practical, other practical thing is like when there was a Gulf, the oil in the Gulf about a couple of years ago, also we used many of the NASA Earth observation instruments actually were used to monitor. And not only monitor it, but also measure the thickness. In some technique, people were developing technique to measure the thickness of that oil. And that had very direct, practical, you know, application. And it came to the attention of many of the politicians. I mean, when we were talking recently with John Holdren, the science advisor to the president, he remembered very clearly that NASA helped, you know, in that natural, you know, issue. And finally, I put also another example in planetary that, you know, you go to some of the planets in our solar system or satellite in our solar system, in this case Enceladus, and you actually see many Earth-like, you know, kind of environments such, in this case, having very large geysers. So that hopefully kind of gives you a quick illustration that a lot of the technology you have developed and the capability you have developed is being used both for scientific, but also for really practical kind of objectives. Now, talking about things coming up, you know, shortly. Now, I have to say I'm a little bit biased toward JPL, not because of that reason, but because that's what I'm familiar with, you know, more than other activities. But if I would have added Goddard and NOAA and so on, I mean, we can spend all morning, you know, talking about the different missions. You know, it's, Aquarius was just launched, you know, about a week ago or 10 days ago. So far, things are looking good. You know, we still have not done complete commissioning of that satellite. And again, to refresh your memory, basically that's a mission jointly with Argentina. And one of the key objective or the US contribution is developing an instrument which will measure ocean salinity using active and passive microwaves. So that brings an additional key parameter in understanding the heat exchange between the atmosphere in the ocean when you combine the salinity measurement with the wind measurement and the current measurement and the temperature, you know, measurement. The next step we have at JPL is the SMAP mission, and that will be launched in 2014, which will give us basically a monitoring and observation of the soil moisture. And there is a whole spectrum of application related to the soil moisture. And actually before that, in 2013, we're on track to launch OCO2 for doing carbon dioxide monitoring. And then, and I put some pictures here, but at the bottom also I list some of the other missions. You know, JASON-3 is a mission that is mainly funded by NOAA and jointly with Europe. GRACE follow-on, we're in the final discussion, you know, between NASA and Germany about basically doing the follow-on for the GRACE mission. And then DESTINY and SWAT are later in this decade whenever the funding actually occur. DESTINY being a synthetic aperture radar, and SWAT is a synthetic aperture altimeter. Now, also to show you a little bit that we are not the only planet here, but to tell you about some of the activity coming up that you'll be hearing about in the news over the next 6-7 months. Literally next month, we'll be encountering, you know, Vesta, which is the second largest, you know, asteroid. Matter of fact, if you go on our website, you can start seeing images, you know, of it rotating. Now, you might say, well, asteroid, what's a big deal? That's a little teeny rock. In actuality, that asteroid is bigger than the state of California. So to give you an idea of the size of it. And then after we spend a year orbiting it, then we will leave it and go to Ceres, which is the largest asteroid, which is almost the size of half of the United States. Now, I mentioned that because later you will see how technology enabled those kind of mission to actually happen. Then in August, we'll be launching a mission which will go to Jupiter, to do microwave sounding of the atmosphere of Jupiter, and that's directly relevant to this group because the technique is exactly how we use atmospheric profiling in Earth by looking at the microwave emission at multiple frequencies or micro spectral band and then doing the weighing function that was all developed for Earth application. Now we're translating exactly the same technique to use it for doing Jupiter profile, you know, atmospheric profile. Then we have GRAIL, and just looking at the picture, it looks exactly like GRACE, and it is exactly like GRACE, using exactly the GRACE technique, you know, of measuring gravity that was demonstrated on Earth. We're using exactly the same technique to measure the gravity, very accurately to map the gravity field, you know, on the moon. So that shows the cross-fertilization between the two scientific disciplines. Then in November, we'll be launching the next rover, which will go to Mars. It's about the size of yours for a small car, if you own a small car. It's about that size. Too bad if your conference was a couple of weeks earlier, we could have brought you to JPL, you would have seen it. It's all packed and it's being shipped basically tonight, you know, to go to the Cape for launch the day after Thanksgiving, and then landing next August next year. And finally, we have a mission called New Star, which will be launching in February. And also the reason I put it in here, other than just to keep you updated of what's going on, you see that little boom which is in there? That's an exact copy of the boom we had on SRTM. Some of you who worked on SRTM or are familiar with SRTM, except it's a shorter boom, but the technique is exactly the same. But here it's being used to basically, one way of thinking about it, to make a long focal plane in the X-ray. So we have, the mirrors are at the end of the boom and the detector is at the spacecraft. So by putting the mirror, you know, about 10 meter out, you know, it kind of make a way of focusing, you know, X-ray. So hopefully that shows you that in the technology that you are working on, who knows, 10 years from now, it could be used on a planetary mission or an astrophysics mission. So there is a lot of fertilization between the different parts of NASA. Now, let me give you a couple of examples. Now, I'm starting with synthetic aperture radar because that's something I'm very familiar with. The DC-8, in my younger days, when I was 10 years old in the 1970s, I used to do a lot of flying on the DC-8, and that was really a platform for demonstrating technology. You know, it was one of the early flights or the early development in synthetic aperture radar, and we were always trying new things. Either new modulation on the modulation signal or getting to different frequencies and figuring out basically how these things work. What is really interesting now, which I am always fascinated with, is now we put these on UAVs. And it's amazing what these UAVs are capable of. You know, I was recently being briefed about a UAV flight that we did, which basically covered between launched from somewhere in Dryden, going to Hawaii, going up to Alaska, coming back. And basically all of the operator and the scientists are just sitting in their office. I'm kind of exaggerating a little. They were sitting at Dryden, but you could have be sitting in your office and actually getting the data and monitoring and operating the instrument. So it kind of remind me a little bit like what people in the astronomy field they do. Before they used to spend their night at the top of the mountain, now they sit down in their office air conditioned and very nice, and they do the measurement the same way. So in a sense, in earth science, we are basically moving, you know, in that direction. And it has an amazing kind of capability of putting, you know, L-band and Ka-band and P-band, you know, across the spectrum, basically being able to make those measurements. And the colorful part that you see here is some of the data, which also is some what I consider amazing development, is by using interferometry to measure basically motion on the surface on the scale of few centimeters, which allow us basically to map motion resulting from earthquakes, and hopefully maybe sometime in the future be able to map the stress field on the surface and maybe be able to predict area or indicate area which are of high risk that the earthquake could happen, or monitoring area where you have volcanic inflation, or monitoring area which are doing subsidence, you know, because you are pumping oil or pumping water from below the surface. So that illustrates example of things which are very practical in addition to being scientifically interesting, but also they are very practical for day-to-day kind of application. And I think these are the kind of things that we need to make sure the public and the politicians and all of these people are aware of, that what we do in earth science is not something esoteric for academics, but it is something that could impact each and every person's life, you know, in one way or another. And therefore, it's worthwhile to spend the taxpayers' money on making sure we do these developments. Other example is collaboration, you know, being done also with industry. So it's not only collaboration between centers or with between academics, but also in capitalizing on industry technology development and vice versa. And these are some examples related to a potential instrument called GeoStar, which will allow us to do basically mapping from geostationary orbit, looking at the atmosphere using very high frequency, microwave, as well as things which have been used on CloudSat, you know, also going into the upper range or in the 50 to 100 gigahertz. And some of these technology could be used in other than remote sensing, kind of applications. Another illustration for how we technology can be used is basically developing technology and flying it on small satellites so we can demonstrate it into a space environment. In this case, what's called CubeSat, which are relatively small, satellite. And here you see collaboration both with industry and university. But the key point here is considering that I deal a lot with project managers, there is always a hesitance about using new technology on major missions. And that's normal. I can say a project manager is normal. They have the reaction that they want to make absolutely sure it works, they want to make sure it's on schedule, they want to make sure it's within their budget. So there is always hesitance on using advanced technology. In my younger days, we had a number of programs where we actually did fly mission exclusively for technology purpose. And that was called the program New Millennium. Some of you are familiar with it because we had some Earth orbiting experiment that Goddard conducted under that program. And for budget reason and so on, that program kind of faded away. But now there is a revival, I think, in the technology at NASA. In addition to the technology which is being done in the different directorate, like Earth Science, but also there are intent and plan, we don't have yet the final budget, of having a technology program, under Bobby Brown or the chief technologist at NASA, where there is interest or objective, not only to develop technology, but also to fly it and demonstrate it, so it can be used with more confidence and more comfort, by a major project on their instruments. So that's area where hopefully many of you are familiar with that program. And I think if you are not, you ought to be familiar, with it, because the possibility is it could grow up to about $1 billion a year. Not all for Earth science. I'm sure Mike Freilich would love to have it all for Earth science, but it really involved across all what NASA does. But many of those applications could be relevant, for Earth science. And this is one example of actually developing an instrument flight on a small spacecraft or on aircraft and actually demonstrate its operation before you put it as an integral part or propose it, for a flight mission. And also to talk about even esoteric, what seems to be esoteric kind of technology using atomic interferometers. And that's an example where GRACE have done great measurement for the gravity field, and we're looking at even more capable GRACE by doing laser link instead of radio link. But also where people are looking at basically using atomic states, and quantum wave interferometers to actually measure the gravity field. Now, I'm not going to go into detail because I don't understand it very well, but to make it at least the extent to I understand it is the gravity field basically have an effect on the quantum states, of atoms, and by measuring some of these quantum states, you'll be able to deduct the field. I think I passed the test, at least probably I'll get a B for what I just said. But the point is, we need to be looking across broad spectrum of technologies which could have application for some of the missions that NASA is developing or contemplating in the future. Another example of collaboration is also working with the DoD. This is an example where there is a lot of interest in warm infrared detectors. Warm is relatively speaking, where instead of having to cool things significantly, you can do detectors in the infrared which are relatively ambient temperature. And there have been a lot of interest in DoD, and this is some of the development of a camera which measured very, very accurately the infrared radiation. But also it has translated into practical application. For instance, this kind of technique, people are looking at it now to help surgeons while they are doing cancer surgery to be able to make sure that they have removed all the cancerous cells. And you say, well, how does that relate to cancer? Well, it turned out that cancerous cells are slightly different temperatures than healthy cells because there is more blood flow, which go into them. And therefore, they have a very, very small change in temperature. And these kind of cameras, can detect that temperature change. So this is an example where something which is developed for earth science, which have application from DOD, but also has application in something very practical. And I can tell you, when I have visitors and I mention that to them, they click and say, wow, really, NASA technology is being very helpful, you know, for, because that's something very personal. Almost everybody would know, or 80% of the people would know some friend or some cousin or somebody that actually had surgery or have some issues, you know, related to cancer, and they see now a direct personal application for them or benefit, you know, for them. Now, the other illustration of technology which is cross-fertilized is in moving much higher in frequency. You see on the left is some of the technology which is developed, and it's being flown on an astrophysics, you know, telescope, which is put on a Boeing 747. You see that big hole, you know, on the right-hand side, that's the opening for the telescope. But also it has a practical application. What you see on the right is by using that kind of terra-earth technology, which have some capability of penetration through clothes, to actually see if somebody is wearing, you know, anything undesirable under their clothes, you know, arms or metallic, you know, objects. So instead of you having to go and spend, 10 seconds in front of that machine at the airport, raising your hands and doing this, now as people are walking by, basically you can make the measurement and see if there are any objects, you know, below the surface. So that's another example where technology which have been developed for NASA kind of application is also being used both for astrophysics as well as being used for a day-to-day practical, you know, application. Moving in the laser area, this is an activity that happening not only at JPL but also at Goddard and Langley. The example that I wanted to show here, it's the amazing amount of technology, I mean, the amazing advancement which have happened in technology. On the left-hand side, that used to be an instrument being developed at JPL when I was a division manager. So, I mean, when I was actually doing real work, you know, doing some science. So this laser used to be 70 kilogram, used to be this big. To measure stratospheric measurement, we have to put it on huge balloons. Well, today you look at the completely right-hand side, this is actually the same thing that we are flying on MSL, you know, and it's a little chip which is about, well, chip or equivalent of a chip, which is about 100 grams. So that's the kind of evolution which have happened just in 20 years. And in between, we developed instrument which flew on airborne, you know, instrument. So just looking at this kind of, show you the potential that just imagine what 20 years from now, the technology you are developing today, there should be no reason, no matter how big it is or how small, that you'll be able to put it in a little package and fly it, be it in Earth's orbit or being flying it to the planets or for a variety, you know, for application. Now, I brought this back to show you it's not only instrument. I know you mostly think about instrument because that's kind of the theme, you know, of the technology in Earth science. But also to illustrate you one example which really enabled mission which would not have been possible is in electric propulsion. You know, we talked for years, you know, since I was at school, people were talking about electric propulsion. But project managers were very hesitant on using it for missions, so we demonstrated it on the New Millennium program about 15 years ago. Well, now the mission that I was mentioning just earlier that is going to Vesta actually is using electric propulsion. Now, in actuality, it's more than using it. The mission would not have been possible, you know, without electric propulsion. Because what we are trying to do is to fly a spacecraft, go to Vesta, go in orbit around Vesta, spend a year, and then leave Vesta, you know, through propulsion, and then go to another object, which is Ceres, and go in orbit around it. If you do the calculation, you find that you need a huge amount of energy to do that. Because you have to slow yourself down to go in orbit, then you have to speed yourself up, then you have to slow yourself down to go in orbit around another planet. So if you go through the calculation, to do that chemically would have required huge tanks, you know, which would have required, you know, some of the largest vehicle, you know, launch vehicle, which would have made it too expensive and almost impossible to do that. It turned out that electric propulsion have a much better ISP, which is an impulse, to that. It takes a long time. You know, the propulsion is very, very gentle, but you run it for like 6 months to a year to 2 years to 3 years, and it makes up, you know, significantly more impulse, you know, than you would have done in a chemical propulsion. So this is an example where actually technology literally enabled a mission to happen that would not have been possible. But now the application of this technology is also to use it on smaller satellites. You know, and basically you can put these electric propulsion devices, if you don't need much impulse, you can put them on a chip. Because all what you need to just excite electrons or ionize, you know, electrons and then put them in an electric field and push them at very high speed. So you can do it on a small scale as well as you can do it on a large scale. So there are a lot of application now on station, orbit stationing or positioning that is being used by military satellite as well as civilian satellites in Earth's orbit. Now, when you think about technology, also you don't need to be thinking only about devices. I think we need to be thinking about also how we advance the data access or the data distribution or basically controlling your satellites. So basically, I tend to think that we ought to be thinking, for instance, of having an interplanetary internet so that you'll be able to be sitting in interplanetary, I'm including the Earth as part of that, that you should be able to connect all your satellite, all your measurements through kind of an internet. Kind of an approach, the same way you do when you have access to multiple kind of servers or multiple kind of computer to get whatever you are trying to do for your experiment. So there is a lot of application and a lot of thinking of building what we call a space-based networking. And actually recently we did do a demo where we used one of our satellite, which was beyond its prime mission, of actually using it as a node for an interplanetary internet. Now, for Earth's application, we don't have the major issue of time delay. But when we have spacecraft which are far, you know, like in orbit around other planets, in the case of Mars, it takes a signal about 10 minutes. Now, you need to work a different protocol than we are accustomed, you know, on the internet, because I'm sure you'll get very upset if you are trying to Google something and it takes 10 minutes for the answer to come back. I don't think that service will stay long with you. You'll probably change service. So people are thinking of how do you do a protocol where you have this time delay, you know, without kind of slowing down what you are doing. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to speed the speed of light or increase the speed of light, but there are functions that you can do with time delays while you are doing other functions. You know, some of the function you asked for, you know, earlier is actually going and propagating, you know, through space. So people are thinking in technology related to the internet and software of how, you know, some advances in that field. And the same thing, I mean, it kind of connected to it is the deployment of sensor webs, where basically you have a variety of instruments, be it on the surface, be it in orbit, be it on airplane. All of them are interconnected, and in some situation, they talk to each other and actually do function based on the results they get from each other without you intervening, you know, into that process. So it could be a measurement which was taken on the ground, which seems interesting, and it will trigger a measurement or turning on an instrument that you have on an airplane or you have in orbit, and vice versa. If from orbit you detect some unusual phenomena, basically you trigger, you know, instrument you have on the surface to actually start making more design measurement for that purpose. And then you can have the scientist, you know, being involved in that activity. So these kind of sensor webs are getting a lot of attention. So that's another tool of technology that basically is being used and will be used in the future. And here there are some couple of examples of recent event. This is a work that, you know, Granat and Donnellan and a number of people have done recently, but basically using models on looking at the ruptures and the propagation which have happened in the earthquake that occurred recently in Japan. So here you are connecting measurement also from doing modeling. And you know, in principle, at the end, what we would like to do is to be able, like you would do in a lab, you do a measurement, you put it into a model, you see how well the model works, then you go and make a measurement, then you improve your model, you know, based on your measurement, and you do cycling on doing that. So the same way you do that in a lab, now we are able to do this kind of thing, you know, by Earth observation, of doing that coupling between modeling, you know, in actual measurements. And finally, I want to show here that in addition of actually doing modeling and doing measurement, is being able to distribute the data very rapidly, you know, to the users. And again, using the earthquake in Japan, I mean, literally as within minutes after we knew that the earthquake was happening, people were actually sending measurement, you know, to the rescue team on actually what was measured, you know, be it from ground earthquake measurements or remote measurements of actually helping, you know, the rescue team about where are the major motion which have occurred and so on. So ultimately, hopefully in the future, you will have both space asset and ground assets, which will be able to help rescuers almost in real time, you know, of doing some of these kind of measurements. So hopefully this kind of gave you a quick overview about, you know, the kind of technology which are happening, the role that you are playing. Now, I'm sure I didn't cover, you know, everybody's, you know, field, and that's because I'm not that smart. But no question, having lived through this field, you know, for most of my career, I think it is amazing how much technology have enabled us to make the measurement that we do today. You know, when I sit down and reflect, you know, on what we used to do in the 70s. I mean, any of you is familiar with synthetic aperture radar. I hate to tell you, we used to put the data on film. And then we used to go and do optical processing 2 days later after we developed the film. I mean, now you have it in real time, you know, on your computer. So just think what will happen, you know, in the next 20 years and the capabilities that will be developed in the next 20 years, you know, resulting from your effort. So with this, I hope you enjoy your conference. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm even going to stay here for a couple of hours. Maybe I'll learn something, and I'll be glad to answer any questions, I assume, if that's okay with you. So thank you very much, and welcome to Pasadena.